Well, speaking of people getting snookered in Canberra, Telstra looks as though it's managed to snooker itself pretty royally. Stephen Mayne is the founder of crikey.com.au and a shareholder activist. He's been watching Telstra's share price crash. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Good, thank you. Stephen, is this what is the best word to describe the Telstra events in the past couple of days?
Well, I guess it's a standoff between the arrogant old monopoly and a new government and regulatory regime. And Telstra, ever since Donald McGauchie became chairman, and remember, Donald McGauchie is one of the ultimate hard men of Australian business. He was the head of the National Farmers Federation during the waterfront dispute. He hired Sol Trujillo, who was absolutely committed to keeping Telstra as an integrated telco. And from the day they got together, they basically went to war with anyone in government or any regulator who dared intrude on Telstra's almighty market power. And this has continued with the change of government. And finally, I think we have a situation where the Rudd government has blinked and has called Telstra's bluff and has kicked them out of the process to spend $10 billion in total on a national broadband network. So it's a very dramatic development, absolute high-stakes clifftop poker. And the fact that Telstra shares fell by 48 cents to $3.65 yesterday, $5 billion wiped out, including $1 billion wiped off the value of the government's stake, which has fallen from $8.2 billion to $7.2 billion, shows that no one's the winner from this as far as either the government or Telstra is concerned, and I think there's a lot of questions around the strategy of the Telstra management and board.
Well, the strategy of the board, we just need to back up a little bit with regard to this bid for its own involvement in the rollout of a broadband network around Australia. When the government put out tenders to have that done, Telstra submitted about a 13-page document.
Yes, it was a very cursory document. There was a lot of talk that Sol Trujillo didn't want to tender anything at all. And I mean, I went to the Telstra AGM just a few days before the deadline for nominations, and they were still arming and ahhing. And then when they finally cobbled together their 12 pages, Sol Trujillo was nowhere to be seen. He disappeared back offshore on one of his trips, and it was Donald McGauchie who was fronting it. And clearly it wasn't a compliant bid, as the panel has advised over the weekend, and the government has stuck to the letter of the process. You didn't have a component in the bid which catered for small and medium enterprise businesses in your bid, therefore you're out. And I think that it's a shock waves all round. Donald McGauchie has attacked this as being a trivial reason, and Sol Trujillo has finally re-emerged on the debate to launch a big attack. When he was conspicuously absent from the debate when the so-called bid was actually lodged. So I think you've got quite a bit of dysfunction at board and management level with Telstra as to how they play the process. Do they bid? Is it a compliant bid? What should they do? But now they all seem to be at one in getting back to their normal position, which is attacking the government and the regulator for not letting them do whatever they like.
Though it's interesting because this was an election promise by the Rudd government. Now they're slowly working through their list trying to deliver on these promises. How important do you think the rollout of this kind of broadband network is for Australia? Is this kind of huge investment necessary?
Well, there's a lot of people who argue that given the increasing speed of ADSL and particularly Telstra's new wireless 3G network, which will be dramatically increasing in speed from February next year when it will go from 3 megabits to 21 megabits. We have the world's best wireless network. I use wireless at home and I can watch endless videos, absolutely no worries at all. So there is an argument from some people that we don't need to spend $10 billion cabling the country, particularly all the regional areas, covering 98% of the population, with a broadband cable network when we already have the world's best wireless network, which can be improved on. You know, a lot of other countries have very fast cable broadband, and it was a promise by the government to do it. They do seem committed to it. And so I think we are in a process, but it's unclear what will happen. I mean, will any of the other consortiums be up to the job? Will Telstra give them access to their copper wire? Will Telstra fight them all the way to the High Court? An enormous amount of variables in this process, but you can bet your bottom dollar there will be conflict and disputation all the way.
Now, meanwhile, there's some great unity around this government spending splurge, at least between the governments who are spending the money and receiving it. The Treasurer, Wayne Swan, has announced a $5 billion increase in federal debt to $60 billion.
Now, yes. Well, on Friday we got the $4.7 billion infrastructure splurge. And I think if you look at what happened yesterday, I can't think of a bigger news day in terms of federal government initiated news. A new High Court judge, a carbon trading scheme, Telstra kicked out of the broadband process, and the one that slipped by under the radar, we're increasing federal government debt by $5 billion, which was the announcement that Wayne Swan made yesterday. So from supposedly being in charge of a government that has no net debt, which both sides of politics have been saying, the federal government will this year now borrow $15 billion from the financial markets. At the start of the year, they were only talking about borrowing $5 billion. The total debt will blow out to $60 billion. And interestingly, Wayne Swan's press release talks about using these extra borrowings to reinvest in bonds issued by the state and territory governments. So what we are seeing here, I think, Deborah, is the first move by the federal government to directly fund the state's borrowing programs, because the states have not been able to raise a dollar since the government guarantee was announced, because the state debts aren't formally guaranteed by the Commonwealth. So a very interesting development with the feds stepping up to basically bail out the states, it seems, with their huge and unprecedented borrowing programs.
Is any of that a worry, Stephen?
Well, at a macro level, it's a worry because Australia has a $1 trillion foreign debt, and we have a $60 billion a year current account deficit. So we already owe the rest of the world $1 trillion, and we're on our current spending pattern where we need to borrow an extra $60 billion a year. So that's where you see, if you see the federal government suddenly go from a $22 billion surplus into what a lot of people think will now be a deficit, and now the federal government tapping the markets for $15 billion in funding this year, it is a bit scary, I think, because, I mean, the state governments have got to borrow $20 billion this year. All the states are now massively in deficit when you include their capital programs, when you include their infrastructure spending. They all claim they're in surplus or near surplus because they only talk about recurrent figures. And then you've got the issues in the corporate sector where there's massive debt challenges amongst a whole host of big companies, from the Babcock and Browns to the Centro, and you've got $1 trillion of household debt in Australia, and Australians are the second most indebted households in the world in percentage terms after the British. So all of that, I would say, is a worry, given Australia's dependence on debt, particularly foreign debt, at most levels, be it state, corporate, or household, or federal.
Now, speaking of debt, there's plenty of it in the corporate sector as well, and there's a question about whether the Commonwealth Bank will pull the plug on Centro.
Yes, look, at midnight last night, the latest deadline passed for Centro to repay close to $6 billion of debt to a syndicate of international banks, including a big Australian syndicate. And we still haven't heard any news yet. So the stocks, Centro Property Group and Centro Retail, were both suspended yesterday and won't start trading tomorrow. And there's been quite a bit of press speculation around the role of the Commonwealth Bank, which is the largest secured creditor. They have $1 billion of secured debt and another $250 million of unsecured debt, that they apparently have been playing hardball with a range of different corporates. So it was the Commonwealth Bank, which was the toughest against Orco, and it was the Commonwealth Bank, which was very, very tough, apparently, with Oz Minerals, which is a big mining company, which is suspended and in crisis talks with its bankers. And if you can believe the weekend press, 22 of the 23 Centro bankers and financiers had signed off on the proposal with the Commonwealth Bank as the one holdout. So, and we're still waiting to see what happens. So it's real cliff-top poker at Centro. If it does collapse, it will be Australia's biggest collapse. It owes $15 billion across the entire Centro family. It's in control of 777 shopping centres, the majority of which are in the US. And there's a lot of talk about if Centro goes under, it will just decimate the retail shopping centre market in Australia, and all these shopping centres just come on for sale. So it's a very delicate situation, and it's a situation replicated across the country with teetering corporates. Do their banks give them a lifeline, or do they pull the plug, as has occurred already, obviously, with the ABC Learnings and the Orcos of this world?
And does this, if it tips over, I mean, we don't know, but it always comes down to the one holdout banker. It seems that a lot of these kinds of arrangements, everybody's signed on except for the one holdout banker. Would that have implications for other big shopping centre companies? For example, Westfield.
Well, Westfield, everyone says, is the strongest shopping centre company in the world. I mean, they do still owe about $15 billion of debt, but they've got close to, it's more than $40 billion of shopping centres. So, and Frank Lowy, his share price hasn't fallen that much. He has no debt on his personal shares. So I think Westfield is in a league of its own. But certainly in terms of the broader property market, I mean, we've already seen the whole real estate investment trust market just get crashed. Macquarie Office, which is a big prestigious office manager, it owns One Martin Place in Sydney, the Western. Its shares have crashed by close to 90% to sort of barely 20 cents. So even the great Macquarie Bank have done the shirts of their investors in their office trust. GPT, which is Australia's largest prestigious office owner, had to be bailed out by the Singapore government. Centro is on its knees, pleading for life support, a new injection rollover from its bankers. So a lot of people say the Australian economy is overly reliant on property, that we all dream of owning our homes. We've all enjoyed the property bubble, the housing bubble. We've all used it as our ATM, and we've all consumed based on debt on our homes. And I think there is a big issue around that. Too much debt on property, too much of a property bubble, and Centro collapsing, throwing literally many hundreds of shopping centres onto the market in a fire sale, is a pretty messy signal to the broader property sector in Australia, which is in great distress at the moment.
My guest this morning is Stephen Mayne. He's the founder of crikey.com.au and a shareholder activist. Stephen, with great interest, I've watched the fall of the Bernard Madoff collection of extremely wealthy people who are now pleading for help after they played the greediest game in town.
Look, I'm lost for words on this story, Deborah. It is the greatest financial fraud in history, in my view. You have the former chairman of the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, a guy called Bernard Madoff, who since 1960 has been an investment manager. And it's now been revealed that he was basically running a Ponzi scheme whereby he was paying out returns of 10 to 12% a year based on the new monies that were coming in. How did he get away with it? Well, he was his own securities trader, so he did all his own trading himself. He had some two-bob auditor who no one's ever heard of, with only three staff in just north of New York City. And the US regulators, the SEC, supposedly inspected his books a couple of years ago and gave him a green light. Obviously, they are now shamefully embarrassed by this. And ironically, Bernard Madoff was an advisor to the SEC on how investment funds should be regulated. So, I mean, the original Ponzi scheme was promising to for investors to double their money in 90 days based on the value of international postage stamps. And this was a 1930s scheme, and Mr. Ponzi went to jail for 3 years for dudding $15 million. I mean, literally, it looks like $75 billion Australian dollars has been defrauded here. The list of victims around the world, Steven Spielberg's charity, HSBC, $1.5 billion. The biggest Spanish bank, Santander, $5 billion. The Royal Bank of Scotland, $900 million. Big French bank, BNP, $600 million. So far, we haven't heard anything about Australian losses, but it's almost the final ignominy, I think, for the whole American financial system. I mean, in the same day, same week, you've got the president having shoes thrown at him. You've got Senator Obama's seat being supposedly auctioned off, and now you've got the chairman of the NASDAQ Stock Exchange running as the world's biggest Ponzi scheme. I mean, I don't think it can get any worse or more embarrassing for the Americans, and the obvious response will be a massive increase in regulation and the conclusion that cowboy capitalism with the tax haven hedge funds not being transparent. Those days are gone, and it's blown up in a spectacular way.
Well, it is hard to toss Bernard Madoff and his investors as losers of the year, but nonetheless, let's look back at the year. The biggest disaster, Stephen, in your eyes?
Well, I mean, if you take an international perspective, it's got to be Madoff. But if you look at the Australian scene, I think it's ABC Learning. I'm still confused as to where the $3 billion went, how Australia's most subsidised company, getting $1 million a day out of the taxpayer, basically providing childcare to Australians, how that can lose $3 billion, I'm not sure. And I'm on the creditors committee. I still haven't worked it out. And obviously the chaos for parents, the taxpayers having spent $70 million, the appalling governance, the appalling regulation, I think that goes down as the disaster of the year in Australia.
What was the positive in the year?
Well, with stock markets down by 50%, it's the greatest financial crash since the Great Depression. It's hard to think of too many positives, but the one that stands out for me is the fact that in Australia, the financial services sector got to be at its peak about 44% of the value of the Australian stock market, and globally it peaked at about 30%. And at the end of the day, this was just a lot of paper shufflers and ticket clippers, sharp suits coming up with schemes which were totally unjustified. So I think that the wipeout of all the financial engineers and the final recognition that banking and finance is actually just like a utility, they should be like power companies, they should be like train companies. It's a utility and a service to the public, and it should be about 10% of the stock market value, not 40% as in Australia. So I think there'll be a long-term benefit from getting back to plain old simple finance. Banks take deposits and lend money, and getting away from sort of unregulated $50 million bonuses, tax haven hedge funds, Bernie Madoff, and all the things that came with that. I think it'll be good to see that washed out of the system.
Well, what's the big lesson for individuals this year out of it?
Well, I think particularly in the Australian context, it's just a simple message of live within your means. Spend what you've got and don't go into debt. And debt is the big problem at the moment in Australia and globally. We've all been living beyond our capacity, and we've got a hell of a hangover to deal with now. So I think if you're in debt at the moment, the key challenge is just to hang on to what you've got, because it's not a good time to be selling anything. And remember the lesson that in the last crash in 91, Rupert Murdoch, Frank Lowy, Dick Pratt, Kerry Packer all had their own different degrees of financial crisis. They all managed to hang on to their assets, unlike the Alan Bonds and the Christopher Scases. And those four gentlemen are today the four richest people in Australia. So if you've got too much debt, just hang on for grim death, and the asset values will come back over time, but it's obviously going to be a pretty rocky ride.
Is that your prediction for the year ahead?
Well, I think long term we'll recover quite nicely, but I am very scared about the debt crisis, and I think that from here we could see our banks fall by 20, 30, 40%. We could see the All Ordinaries below 3,000. There'll definitely be a recession, and there'll definitely be a big surge in unemployment and a reduction in house prices. But that's in the next 6 to 12 months. I think you look 2 to 3 years out, and I think people will look back at this time and say, amazing chaos, we learned some lessons, but ultimately it was a great buying opportunity.
Stephen, thanks, and have a Merry Christmas. It's been great to have you as part of the program this year.
It's a pleasure, Deborah.
We'll look forward to it next year as well. A bit more clifftop poker from Stephen Mayne in the new year.